Listening Library presents Berliners by Vesper Stamper. Read for you by Clifton Duncan and the author. This audiobook includes a bonus PDF of a glossary and resources.
The line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart, and through all human hearts. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, The Gulag Archipelago. Vergangenheitsbewältigung, confronting or reckoning with the past. Betriebsblindheit, selective blindness. The young in every age are the first to pay for the folly of their elders. To every student around the globe who has weathered the recent seismic changes in our world, I see you. I write for you. You are not alone. It's time to reclaim your fire. A note about the setting. The state of the world in 1961 combined post-war trauma with the new threat of mutually assured destruction. The nuclear bombs that annihilated Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 demonstrated how high the stakes were in the game of our existence. Humanity had nearly lost control and was seeking to reset itself in every sphere, from arts to governance, from economics to education. While Marxist theory dated back to the early 1800s, emerging from philosophies of the previous century, and had been tried on smaller scales, communism on a national scale in the Soviet Union, China, Cuba, and elsewhere was an experiment that was less than 50 years old. It left a trail of bloodshed and suppression that would not be revealed for several more decades, vastly outnumbering the deaths in World War II. This multinational march of totalitarianism was emerging at the same time as another new phenomenon: numerous civil rights movements worldwide, including in the United States. Black veterans of World War II returned to a country for which they had risked their lives, but still denied them full freedom and equality. In the shadow of the Holocaust, many societies were beginning to recognize the necessity of enshrining equal rights under the law, acknowledging that the state exists to serve the citizen, not the other way around. In 1945, Berlin, as the capital of the Nazi regime, was the final frontier for the Allied troops fighting in the European theater. Hitler's regime had all but collapsed as his hodgepodge army of old men and child soldiers, the Volkssturm, tried to hold out against Russia's Red Army and the British, American, and French troops who were to follow. In order to forestall the emergence of any government tainted by the Nazi order after the defeat of the German Reich, the Allies formed a power-sharing agreement that would diffuse governance and allow for Germany's reconstruction, both governmentally and ideologically. Thus, Germany as a whole, and Berlin as a capital, was split among the four victorious Allied powers. The West, the United States, Britain, and France, and the East, the Soviet Union, represented two different approaches to rooting out Nazism from both the populace and the institutions. Because the Soviet Union was already proceeding at full throttle with the communist experiment, Joseph Stalin and his German allies returning from exile implemented a socialist government in Eastern Germany immediately, with a policy of totalizing conformity and suppression of the acknowledgement of former Nazis in their citizenry. In 1949, the Eastern Soviet-controlled sector of Germany proclaimed itself a new separate country, the German Democratic Republic, GDR. It was neither German, as a puppet state of the USSR, democratic, as a one-party autocracy, nor a republic, as a centralized top-down system. And the United States did not formally acknowledge it as a nation until 1975. Meanwhile, in the western half of the country, the Allies initially began a process of denazification. but because National Socialism was deeply entrenched in every institution, they believed the best path toward a free democracy was a policy of reintegration and remembrance. They would accept the existence of former Nazis in their midst, openly acknowledge Germany's crimes, and aim to reconstruct the institutions along democratic principles, believing that cooperation with other democracies would make them welcome once again among the community of free nations. Though Berlin was technically divided among the Allied sectors, it was an open city like any other. But by 1961, because of political repression and economic hardship, thousands of refugees were fleeing the Eastern Bloc countries, including the GDR, every day, using the open city of Berlin as a gateway to the West. If someone could get to East Berlin, all that person would have to do was walk into a Western sector, claim refugee status, and continue on to another free Western country. This resulted in a brain drain of professionals, such as doctors, and a shortage of skilled workers, which would be sure to crash the fragile economy if something was not done to stop it. The GDR began to pass increasingly restrictive laws preventing East Berlin residents from working in and traveling to West Berlin, until the country's leader, Walter Ulbricht, took the ultimate action, erecting a barrier around the entire western half of the city in the middle of the night on August 13, 1961. Even though it was West Berlin that was encircled by the wall, it was East Berlin that would be truly captive for the next 28 years.
April 1945. Stunde Null. When he thought about it years later, it was the book in the piano bench that had tipped him off. Herr Riescher was in the kitchen making a cup of tea while Rudolf waited in the parlor for his viola lesson, bored out of his skull. In the low golden light, the room so flowery, so pink, with its armchairs bedecked in cabbage roses, the ticking clock sent him into an afternoon drowse. Rudolf hated the viola. It had none of the panache of the violin, none of the glitter of the piano, which was his first instrument. He had only convinced his parents to let him take these lessons so he could get closer to Goethe. Today she wasn't even home, out with Frau Buchner on some errand. So Rudolf, after chewing his nails to nubs, picking at the callus on his left index finger and rosining his bow a third time, lifted the hinged lid of the piano bench and rifled through to see if there was anything interesting. And there it was. Under the Christmas carols and Volkslieder, a book written in those funny letters he knew only Jews could read, and underneath the title, the translation, Yiddish Ballads. Rudolf chalked it up to the collection of an eccentric musical couple. People had already begun accumulating artifacts for the time when those people would be extinct. Even though he was given his Hitlerjugend uniform and told to be on the lookout for hidden Jews, it still did not click in Rudolf's mind. But when, on another afternoon several weeks later, Herr Richter opened the cabinet to put more cigarettes into his brass pocket case, Rudolf spotted a small silver cup not much bigger than a schnapps glass and thought he made out the distinctive shape of a six-pointed star incised on its side. Then he knew. It had to be true. Goethe Richter was Jewish. All this time, he had been fantasizing not about a girl, but about a Jew. It wouldn't have mattered before, in the days prior to the Nuremberg laws, but it did now. The thought simultaneously repulsed him, mainly because he'd been told it should repulse him, and excited him. He had something to report at the next HJ meeting. It pained him, too, because he knew he would have to renounce Goethe, purge himself of her. He would have to harden his heart and train himself to hate her. Because he knew he would have to turn Goethe in.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?